Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the continuing machinations of a sulking sore loser who lost both the popular vote and the Electoral College by wide margins, yet persists on blocking a transition with the help of craven Republicans who have placed partisanship over patriotism as this pathetic pantomime plays out, hobbling and weakening America. Paul Waldman, a columnist at the Washington Post, where his latest article is, "It's Time for Everyone to Pick a Side, America or President Trump," joins us to discuss how, quote, "we are witnessing an attempted murder of democracy, and the fact that it won't succeed makes it no less horrifying." And while some may find it amusing to see hair dye drip down Giuliani's contorted face as he spews out fantastical claims while his flurry of preposterous lawsuits get tossed, there is a looming possibility Trump will continue salting the earth to cripple Biden's presidency, leading rallies for the next 4 years of Lockup Joe and Hunter Biden. Although we have surely reached a point where you either believe in American democracy and are loyal to your country, or believe in Trump and are loyal to him, the fact that we are at that dismal divide is in itself an American tragedy. Then, with the impulsive practitioner of kidnapping, torture, murder, and dismemberment, the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman hosting the virtual G20 summit underway, we'll speak with Justin Sheck, the co-author of the new book Blood and Oil, Mohammed bin Salman's Ruthless Quest for Global Power, a Pulitzer Prize-winning finalist who has been writing for The Wall Street Journal since 2007, covering white-collar crime across four continents. He joins us to discuss MBS's efforts to attract foreign investment, at the same time acting with heavy-handed impunity and boundless greed in his pursuit of absolute power. Then finally, we'll go to Australia, where last Thursday, the head of the Australian military, General Campbell, told the world about the findings from a 4-year military inquiry into the brutal warrior culture inside its elite SAS special forces, revealing the murder of 39 Afghan civilians who were executed to blood junior officers. Joining us is Chris Masters, the award-winning Australian journalist and author of No Frontline, Australian Special Forces at War in Afghanistan, who first broke the story of an Australian war hero now accused of being a war criminal, for which he and the Sydney Morning Herald are being sued by a billionaire press baron. And before we go to our first guest, I want to thank you, our listeners and supporters, who have donated to sustain and build Background Briefing as the radio station we broadcast from closes down and we transition to online broadcasting, particularly during this pandemic. Your donations will help us improve our recording capabilities from home, so we encourage you to throw us a lifeline and join the fact-based community of listeners we are building around the globe with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate, which helps keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to all those who are not in a position to contribute. And joining us now is Paul Waldman, a columnist at the Washington Post Plumline and a senior writer at the American Prospect. He's the author of Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success, and he has an article at the Washington Post, It's Time for Everyone to Pick a Side, America or President Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Waldman.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us. In your article, you say we are witnessing an attempted murder of democracy, and the fact that it won't succeed makes it no less horrifying. And indeed, it does feel like we are being passive spectators to the train wreck of American democracy. And even President-elect Joe Biden is saying, no, he doesn't want to investigate Trump. He wants to not look back, but look forward. So what's going to be done, do you think, Paul, to break the spell of the 77% of the 73 million Americans who voted for Trump who believe that he won the election, which was stolen by the Democrats?
I don't think anything is going to break the spell. I think that the idea that this election was stolen from him and that Joe Biden is an illegitimate president is going to be, for the next few years, what birtherism was during the Obama administration. It's the way that his opponents will tell themselves that he's not legitimate, And he isn't even one of us. In that case, it was that Barack Obama wasn't really an American. In Biden's case, it will be that he is part of a grand international conspiracy that stole the election. And therefore, if he's not a legitimate president, not only do you not have to treat him with the respect that that belongs to the office, but almost any tactics will be justified in opposing him. And I think that we could really be in for a very dangerous time in American politics, especially if, you know, this happens at all levels. If we step back and think about it, you have Republican office holders, most of whom are going to not come out and say that Biden stole the election, but they're going to kind of hint at it. They're going to give those little sort of signals to the base that they're on their side about this. Then you're going to have the great mass of Republican voters who will keep talking about the stolen election, who will all the way through, as long as Biden is president, feel that any tactics are justified in order to oppose him. And then, perhaps most dangerous, on the fringe, you may have some people who decide that politics has just failed them, and that if Donald Trump wasn't reelected, if he couldn't overcome this conspiracy, whatever it is, in their minds, that then that means that other means must be utilized in order to achieve their ends, including violence. And that's the thing that I'm most nervous about. And you know, right now, if you look at it, what's going on, there are all kinds of even more mainstream people who are justifying violence. You know, people may have seen that Kyle Rittenhouse, the young man who went to Kenosha with his assault rifle and killed two people, just got bailed out of jail with $2 million in contributions, including, for instance, from the guy who owns MyPillow, who goes to the White House to advise Donald Trump on how to deal with the pandemic. So these are people who are, you know, within the Republican Party, and they are celebrating somebody who killed two people in service of a right-wing agenda. And so why would it be a surprise that, for instance, you know, a group of extremists has a plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan and take over the state house and mount public executions? We now know that was what they were actually planning, was to have a series of rolling public executions over a period of weeks. That this is the kind of thing that bubbles up on the right when it's given oxygen by the people who are supposed to be more in the mainstream. And so that's the near future that I'm really worried we're gonna see more of.
And if you put this Paul Wolman in a foreign policy context or a geopolitical context, what explains then why Americans again are allowing themselves to be divided and to turn against each other in a way that only serves the interests of despots like Putin and Xi Jinping? They must be absolutely thrilled with the outcome of this election, not so much the outcome of the election, which neither of them, by the way, have congratulated Biden, but the division and Trump's salting the earth. And as you point out, for the next 4 years, a big chunk of the American people that will not treat Biden as a legitimate president and therefore weaken his presidency. But the point is, this will weaken America. So go figure.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. If we think back to 4 years ago and the way that Vladimir Putin helped Donald Trump get elected, when we tried to figure out what his motives were, there may have been, you know, particular things that he thought he could get more out of a Trump administration than out of a Hillary Clinton administration. But the consensus was that he really wants to just sort of discredit American democracy and anything he can do to sow chaos. And, you know, he's done it in other countries' elections as well as ours. And he surely saw in Donald Trump a vehicle for chaos, that it would discredit American democracy if he were elected. So Putin tried to help him in any way he could. Whatever you think of, you know, whether or not it rises to the level of a criminal conspiracy in terms of the participation of Trump in his campaign, that's certainly, you know, there's no question that Putin was trying very hard to help him get elected. And that seemed to be the motivation. And then you fast forward to 2020, and everyone kind of assumed that he would try to help Trump get reelected. And it didn't really seem to happen, at least not on the scale and with the sort of organized effort that we saw 4 years ago. And, it's not easy to figure out what Putin's motives may have been, but he may well have looked at the situation and said, maybe I've achieved all the chaos I could out of Donald Trump being president for years, and maybe now the thing that will I'll just I will look forward to even more chaos if Trump loses, and that will exacerbate those divisions. And the other thing is that, even though we now have a president-elect who's going to always be out there, saying we need to unify the country and we all have to come together and I'm going to be a president for all Americans, whether you voted for me or not. Those are all very nice words, and it's good to see the president-elect saying them. It will be good to see a president saying them, but we have to remember, Barack Obama said he was going to unify the country. George W. Bush said he was going to unify the country. Bill Clinton said he was going to unify the country. And I'm sure they all sincerely wanted it to happen, but it didn't. And especially now, it's going to be extremely difficult. And you're going to see elected Republicans who see it in their political interest for there to be as much division as possible. Because, after all, if you're the opposition party, what's going to help you win the midterm elections and make the president as unsuccessful as possible? Well, it's not working with him. It's not helping him to pass legislation that improves the lives of Americans. That doesn't help. What helps you is chaos, gridlock, inefficiencies in government, economic suffering. Those are the things that help you if you're the opposition party. That's what they learned when Barack Obama was president, that could be a very effective strategy. If they just stonewalled and sabotaged the economy and, did things like threaten to default on America's debts, that wouldn't be blamed on them. The president is the guy who gets the blame, whether he deserves it or not, just like he often gets the credit, whether he deserves it or not. And so, there's not going to be a lot of forces other than Joe Biden's words who are actually promoting unity.
Right, and that kind of sabotage is already happening with the Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, who is already stymieing Biden's forthcoming efforts to stimulate the economy by shutting down the Fed program. So the writing is on the wall, and again, I'm speaking with Paul Wolman, a columnist at the Washington Post Plumline and a senior writer at the American Prospect. He's the author of Being Right Is Not Enough: What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success, and he has an article at the Washington Post, It's Time for Everyone to Pick a Side: America or President Trump. So I guess this means then, Paul, that there won't be any end to this sort of salting the earth, tying Biden's hands by not allowing a transition. I can't see any reason why Trump will stop doing what he's doing all the way through to the 20th of January 2021, when he might well be evicted from the White House. But is it possible then he will spend the next 4 years leading rallies around the country of Lock Up Joe and Hunter Biden?
I think it's certainly possible. The thing that is concerning the other ambitious Republicans who want to run for president in 4 years is whether or not he is going to run again, which, he could under the Constitution. You can serve 2 terms; they don't have to be consecutive. I sincerely doubt that he's actually going to run. But what he will do is he will keep dropping hints about running or saying maybe I'm going to run, because he knows that as long as he's a potential future presidential candidate, he's still relevant and will still write articles about his tweets and pay attention to what he has to say. If he is just an angry, bitter ex-president with no political future, then you can safely ignore him. And there's nothing that he needs more than attention. That's been the case his entire life. So he'll continue to try to get that attention and try to put himself at the center of the Republican Party, not because he has any kind of, particular political or policy agenda, but just because that is what will get him the attention and have people, come praising him, coming to Trump Tower to try to win his favor, and that kind of a thing. Now, it could be possible for the entire Republican Party to essentially say, we don't want to have anything to do with you anymore. And that sometimes happens to people who lose. They take on a particular kind of stink. After George W. Bush left office with the approval ratings in the 20s, every Republican in Washington suddenly became the one person who never liked him anyway, despite the fact that none of it was true. And I think you're going to see a lot of that too in the coming days, of people saying, "Well, I really objected to what he was doing," even if their objections seem to have taken place only in their own minds. But at the same time, so that's one potential, motivating force and incentive Republicans have to distance themselves from him. But at the same time, there is still going to be a huge market for Trumpism in the Republican Party. And those people who are ambitious and who want to run for president in 4 years, they're going to look out at their Republican base and say, you know what? You know what sells with these people? Donald Trump is what sells. So maybe I can make myself as much as possible like him so that they'll like me too in the same way that they adored him. Now, I think it's going to be difficult. A lot of those people are black holes of charisma. People like Tom Cotton, Josh Hawley, they don't have the kind of, compelling thing that Donald Trump has.
Ted Cruz.
He's not exactly somebody who people are drawn to. So we don't we will we'll have you'll have to see yet if they can pull that off. But they are certainly going to be doing a lot of things to try to imitate his style and his sort of scorched earth sort of politics and making characterizing every Democrat as an implacable enemy, tossing around insults. I think we're going to see a lot of them trying to act as much as possible like Trump, even if underneath it there's certainly more substance than he might have had.
Well, it's already happening with Pompeo, the Secretary of State. So he's clearly ambitious and angling to be the head of the Republican ticket as long as you say, Trump doesn't run again in 2024. But he's obviously going to keep dangling that possibility. Do you think it's possible, though, that even on the inauguration day, because of Trump's vindictive and petty nature, that he might have an alternative, not an inauguration, but a press conference of sorts to announce his 2024 run?
It's entirely possible. It'll be interesting to see because once the Electoral College actually meets, and I guess it's the second week of December, Joe Biden will officially be the president-elect. And there won't be anything Trump will be able to do, even at that point, certainly. There's very little he can do right now. So what will happen to him over that last month in office? What is he going to be doing? Well, he's going to be pardoning his friends, and trying to, do everything he can to undermine the incoming Biden administration. But in terms of himself personally and how he draws attention to himself, he might just go back to Mar-a-Lago and sulk and play golf. That's possible. But he also might sort of, jump up and down and say, "Look at me, look at me." And you could see him holding an alternative rally on inauguration day. I think that for those of us in the media, the best way to handle that is to perhaps take note of it, but not give it one hundredth of the attention that we give to the actual important news of the day, which will be a new president being inaugurated. And it's going to be a challenge going forward as to when Trump tries to do that kind of, performative trolling, trying to get attention. How much attention do we give it? Given the fact that he still will probably retain the loyalty of a lot of Republicans, he could be an important political force in the party moving forward. There's a lot of reasons why you might or might not want to actually give it any kind of oxygen. He'll still matter, so it's hard to say that there's nothing newsworthy about it when he does that. But you're absolutely right. I think that he probably doesn't even know yet what he wants to do on inauguration day. But you know that he will be seething at the idea that not only is Joe Biden becoming president, but that all the attention is on him, and the whole event has a subtext, which is that Donald Trump is a loser. And that's the one thing that he has spent his entire life trying not to be. He has contempt for losers. He thinks that every human interaction practically is a competition where somebody wins and somebody loses. And so much of his energy and thought and time has gone into making sure that he's the one you look at and say, "That guy's a winner," and not the one you look at and say, "That guy's a loser." Well, now he has lost on the biggest possible stage. And he will forever be, in some ways, a loser. And I know that that has to tear him up inside. So who knows how he'll lash out on that day when it's more obvious than ever.
Well, I think in the month after the Electoral College verdict giving the presidency to Biden on December the 14th, I've heard reports that he's already auctioning off pardons, not just giving pardons, but selling them, along with the possibility that he could also sell state secrets. So is there a way to have some kind of public tribunal? I mean, the thing that is so disappointing about Biden and was about Obama back in 2008, that he never helped anybody to account for what happened on Wall Street. He wanted to look forward and not back, and that's what Biden's already said. So is there a way to operate around Biden? Is there any way for former presidents or, you know, noted Americans with heft and bipartisan respect to do some kind of tribunal? I mean, this guy, Trump, has been one step ahead of the sheriff all of his professional life, and the dirt that's out there hasn't not even begun to be dredged up, frankly, or at least the dots have not been connected.
Yeah, it'll have to happen piecemeal. There isn't going to be some kind of big, you know, equivalent of the 9/11 commission or the Truth and Reconciliation events that happened in South Africa. It's going to be individual people who have some kind of authority who want to put something like that on. You know, you've got prosecutors in New York who are pursuing cases against him and his family for some of the things that they've gotten away with, which looks like tax fraud and bank fraud and things like that that are potential crimes. Then, you know, people in Congress could mount investigations that cover what he did in office. I think they absolutely ought to, but they're going to come under pressure from the White House probably, because Biden looks like he doesn't have any appetite for this and doesn't want to sort of wallow in the Trump years, which I suppose from his perspective is understandable, but it also sends a signal that, you know, if you can make it through your 4 years, then you get a get out of jail free card. It's conceivable that the Justice Department could have some kind of case against him for some federal crimes, which we don't yet know about. And Biden, what he said about that is that he's not going to tell the Justice Department who to prosecute and who not to prosecute, which is the position that has been taken by just about every president up until now, until Donald Trump, with possible exception of Richard Nixon. But, you know, I think if you were a Justice Department official, you'd probably know that maybe it wasn't the most, you know, politically opportune thing if the president has expressed that he's not interested in it. But, you know, what we should expect for them is if there's evidence that a crime was committed, they should investigate it. And if they conclude that a crime was committed, then they should prosecute. And that should apply to ex-presidents just the same as it applies to any other American. So, you know, you have all these sort of different people in different places who could begin to kind of chip away at that edifice of concealment, and figure out what Donald Trump has gotten away with. And there are some things that are really obvious. You know, Michael Cohen, for instance, his former consigliere, you know, he spent a couple of years in jail for, in part for a conspiracy to violate campaign finance laws, where he made clear that he was ordered to do it by Donald Trump. And, like, there's no question that there was a crime, and Cohen went to jail for that crime. And Donald Trump was a participant, was the leader of that conspiracy to violate campaign finance laws. So, you know, there are some things that are absolutely obvious, and then there are some things that are yet to be discovered. But I do think that if we want to say that we have a system where no one is above the law, then the things that Donald Trump did that are potentially criminal ought to be investigated just as they are with anyone else.
Well, Paul Wolman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Wolman, who's a columnist at the Washington Post, Plumline, and a senior writer at the American Prospect. He's the author of Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. And he has an article at the Washington Post, It's Time for Everyone to Pick a Side, America or President Trump. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the impulsive practitioner of kidnapping, torture, murder, and dismemberment, the Saudi Crown Prince, who is now hosting a virtual G20 summit. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Justin Sheck, who is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal since 2007, covering white-collar crime across four continents, as well as writing about Saudi Arabia and energy-related stories. A Pulitzer Prize finalist, he's the co-author with Bradley Hope of the new book, just out, Blood and Oil, Mohammed bin Salman's Ruthless Quest for Global Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Justin Sheck.
Thank you, Ian, for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us. And obviously, the G20 summit is underway, hosted by Saudi Arabia and by Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince, and his ailing father, King Salman. There have been a number of boycotts, and most of it's being done virtually. The President Trump addressed it, the summit, virtually on Saturday. But how's it working out? I mean, it's extraordinary to think that this could happen. I know the chair of the G20 rotates, but how did the Saudis pull off this in the first place, given the, you know, disgraceful record of this crown prince?
So, you know, by way of context, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, who's, you know, the day-to-day ruler of the kingdom, unlike most preceding Saudi rulers, has sort of had to make his way to the top in important ways within his family. He's had to elbow aside rival relatives and prove to his family members and his people that he is someone who, as one person in our book put it, can do kingly things. And so there are public symbolic things that he puts a lot of stock in. And I think, you know, starting a war in Yemen just a few weeks after he became the head of the Saudi military is an example. Another example was his big conference called Davos in the Desert a few years ago. We brought in, you know, many of the world's most prominent bankers and business people, had him come to Saudi Arabia to show he could bring them there. Donald Trump's visit, his first foreign visit as president in 2017, was another symbolic gesture to show that Mohammed bin Salman is bringing Saudi Arabia out into the world in a way that it hadn't been before, and is bringing the world to Saudi Arabia. And so for him, prior to COVID, the G20, even though, as you said, it's the chair is rotating, it was like it just happened to be Saudi Arabia's turn. It was not a sign of, you know, any sort of auspicious accomplishment by Saudi Arabia that it was going to host the G20. But hosting the G20 is something that he saw as one more of these events where Mohammed bin Salman would bring the world to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia would show that it was a superpower and an important country, and one that leaders from other countries come to in order to show respect. And he was planning, you know, he had grand plans around this. It was going to be a really huge thing. COVID got in the way. And so the G20 conference we end up with is this, you know, attenuated version that, frankly, I would be paying much more attention to if it was in person, given like the sort of Zoom G20 is not something that has really captured my imagination. And I think, you know, that was a real disappointment to him, because this was supposed to be this landmark thing. But in terms of the question of like how other countries allow it, you know, the G20 chair rotates, and I think, you know, the bar is pretty high to have, you know, other G20 countries kind of, you know, decide that you are a pariah. And I think with the U.S. president's explicit support for Mohammed bin Salman, despite what's happened in Yemen, despite the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, there wasn't really much of a chance that the thing was going to get derailed.
Well, of course, MBS has lost his most powerful and loyal protector, who has just been dethroned here in the United States, although you may not know it. And as you mentioned, that was Donald Trump's first overseas trip, was to Saudi Arabia, where he did the famous sword dance. But the French are obviously letting their displeasure known. There's a massive portrait hanging from the Louvre of the young Saudi activist, the woman who broke the taboo of driving. And she's been in jail now for 3 years. Mohammed bin Salman said about 3 years ago, I think, that she was a spy, and yet they have produced no evidence. So there's an obvious brutality in that country, and he seems to really, I don't know whether he's sadistic, but he certainly knows how to mete out punishment, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, but I think there are nuances to the, I'm not arguing there's brutality, but I think there are nuances to these situations that help inform us when trying to understand the brutality. And so what happened with Lujaina Hafloul, the driving activist, and others, they were calling for Saudi Arabia to allow women to drive, and they were holding protests. And Mohammed bin Salman and his father, the king, decided a few years ago that they would allow women to drive. And so, right, you know, not there wasn't much time in between when they announced they were going to allow women to drive and when they arrested the activists who were calling on women to drive. And the first, I think, probably most important thing to understand is that Mohammed bin Salman sees reform in Saudi Arabia as a social and economic enterprise and not as a political enterprise. So I as an American, I think many of us in the U.S. and Europe sort of think of social and economic and political freedom as being part of the same universe of rights. And in Mohammed bin Salman's conception of Saudi Arabia, there may be more economic freedom and more social freedom, but there will be no political freedom, or maybe even less political freedom than there had been. So he wants to show that whatever rights you get in Saudi Arabia, whether it's the right to drive as a woman or the right to open up a company or whatever, comes from the ruling family. It comes from him and his father. It doesn't come from your complaints and your protests in the street. And in fact, he wants to show that your complaints and your protests in the street will land you in prison. So that's the first important point. The second one is that he has this deep-seated suspicion that people who object to him are part of one of several conspiracies to undermine him. And it's not entirely illogical because, you know, coming up, sort of gaining power within the House of Saud and paving his father's way to the throne, he had a lot of relatives, especially the sons of the prior king, King Abdullah, who really were trying. They were part of an organized effort to get in their way. And the truth is that, you know, just as he and his government are organizing efforts to defeat Iran and to mess with Qatar, Qatar and Iran are doing things against them. So he has a tendency to see people who are protesting him not as being sincere and earnest and not wanting to do what they say they want to do, but as having ulterior motives that have to do with weakening him. And so, you know, he's accused these women driving activists of being part of some Qatari-led plot to topple him or to undermine him. And whether he believes these things or whether he's saying these things to, you know, make a point or like isn't really clear and doesn't really matter that much, because the message he's trying to send is that if you publicly oppose me, I will see you as part of some conspiracy to undermine me and you will suffer.
And again, I'm speaking with Justin Sheck, who is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal since 2007, covering white-collar crime across four continents, as well as writing about Saudi Arabia and energy-related stories, a Pulitzer Prize finalist. He's the co-author with Bradley Hope of the new book just out, Blood and Oil, Mohammed bin Salman's Ruthless Quest for Global Power. So, obviously, this is a family-run absolute monarchy, and whether or not this young Crown Prince, who I imagine will be king relatively soon because his father's apparently got dementia. Is there something else going on here in the sense that there have been uprisings across the country, particularly in the areas where the oil actually is, which is has a large Shia population? You've got shrinking state income, skyrocketing expenditures, this war in Yemen, and the blockade of Qatar, which I think has a lot to do with wanting to shut down Al Jazeera. And, of course, he's got Iran as an enemy, and they wiped out his oil facility at Labcake in a very well-targeted cruise missile attack from Farsi Island. So I guess it leads me to the question of the moment here, because there's a lot of concern about whether there's going to be some kind of action in the Middle East. And last Thursday, President Trump asked his top officials for, I don't know whether it was plans to bomb Iran, but some kind of effort was made to talk about a military attack on Iran, which the Secretary of State, the Vice President, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs apparently talked Trump out of. So is it possible? Well, let's begin with the question of whether or not this royal family, this father and son, are rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, or will they reach out or use some kind of distraction to distract from their domestic problems, or are things as dire as some analysts suggest they are?
It's a good question. So first off, I would say we can't take it as a given that King Salman has dementia. He might not. We don't know. People in the Saudi royal court deny it. We know his health's not great. He's very old. He's had a series of health problems going back decades. But it almost doesn't matter that much. What matters is that his son, Mohammed bin Salman, is basically running things. And I think part of what you're getting at goes to this central debate within the U.S. political establishment, which is I think there are people who, in the State Department, in the intelligence establishment, who have felt and who had a lot of power under Obama, that the best, that their vision for the Middle East and the best way to try to influence the Middle East was to create a situation where every country had interests in maintaining peace, and every country had interests that were aligned sometimes with their enemies, even if they were still enemies. So, for example, the Iranian nuclear deal. Iran might hate the U.S. and might hate Israel and might hate Saudi Arabia, but if Iran stopped producing nuclear weapons, the U.S. would lift sanctions and it could then trade with all these countries. And the idea is, Israel and Saudi Arabia, the Americans thought, had some skin in the game here because there was less of a nuclear threat, and Iran had skin in the game because it would help fix their economy and all of that. And there was, I think the people who had power under the Obama administration felt that if you could create situations like that around the Middle East where, the Saudis were an ally, but the U.S. would keep them at arm's length and try to pressure them in human rights stuff, and Iran may be an enemy, but the U.S. would keep negotiations open and keep the nuclear deal there. You could create a situation where everyone had interests that worked in the way of peace. There's another school of thought in the U.S. Government that gained more traction with Trump, that the Middle East was inevitably headed in a direction where the Gulf states, so Saudi Arabia and UAE being the most important, and Israel and Egypt and the U.S. would be aligned against Iran, Qatar, Turkey, a couple other countries. And it would basically be you were either on one side or the other one. The U.S. Would, of course, support the side involving Israeli and the Saudis. And it would be this contentious, adversarial future. And I think, Trump pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal and helping pave the way for UAE and Bahrain and Sudan to recognize Israel has sort of helped push things in that direction. I think people felt it was inevitable it would go in that direction. So I don't know if that means war is automatic, but I think it, to me, when I see people turning into two completely adversarial camps, I get nervous. But the big kind of unknown now is what happens with Biden coming in. The Biden people are very much like the Obama people, who I think they're skeptical. Saudi Arabia is a long-time ally, and they're skeptical of that long-time ally in a way that the Trump administration wasn't. And I think, Biden said he is in favor of the nuclear deal, and I think the U.S. is going to be much more hesitant to paint Turkey they're going to treat Turkey a little bit differently, I think. And so I don't really know what that means, but it's hard to see things blowing up in like absolute warfare now. Number one, when Iran attacked the Abqaiq, the Saudi oil installation, Iran did so in a way that was very sophisticated. They kind of targeted facilities that would be pretty easy to fix and wouldn't cause like real long-term damage, to show Saudi Arabia like, A, we can hit you, B, we can hit you very precisely, and C, we're going to be nice this time. And that, Saudi Arabia and the U.S. did not respond with an immediate attack. I think also the Saudi royal court right now realizes that they put in all their chips with the Trump administration. They bet on the wrong horse. Trump lost. And so now they have to kind of come back around and figure out a way forward with Biden and with Biden people who are especially skeptical of them. And I think they're probably going to lay low for a little bit. It's hard for me to see them doing anything too aggressive in the near future.
Well, Justin Check, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but we should revisit this subject and keep an eye on what's happening there. And I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
And again, I'll be speaking with Justin Sheck, who is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal since 2007, covering white-collar crime across four continents, as well as writing about Saudi Arabian energy-related stories, a Pulitzer Prize finalist. He's the co-author with Bradley Hope of the new book, Blood and Oil, Mohammed bin Salman's Ruthless Quest for Global Power. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back to go to Australia to look into the four-year military inquiry into the brutal warrior culture inside its elite special forces with the Australian journalist who first broke the story of an Australian war hero now accused of being a war criminal. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Australia is Chris Masters, who retains the record for the longest-serving reporter on Australia's longest-running current affairs program, Four Corners. For over 25 years, he's made a series of nation-shaping reports, among them The Moonlight State, which helped trigger Queensland's Fitzgerald inquiry, which brought down the corrupt state government. And he has received multiple awards, including the Premier Gold Walkley, the equivalent of the US Pulitzer, for his international expose of the sinking of the Rainbow Warrior. And he's the author of five best-selling books, most recently No Frontline, Australian Special Forces at War in Afghanistan. And in 2017, Chris Masters was inducted into the Australian Media Hall of Fame. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Masters.
Oh, thank you very much, Ian.
And for purposes of full disclosure, you happen to be my brother.
That's right. Yeah. I'm number four and you're number two.
Okay, well, let me ask you, though, about your reporting, since you, in effect, broke the original story, which has now exploded on the international headlines with Thursday's press conference by the head of the Australian military, General Angus Campbell, announcing that Australian soldiers were involved in war crimes in Afghanistan. Specifically, 39 Afghans were unlawfully killed in 23 incidents. This forced the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, to apologize to Ashraf Ghani, the president of Afghanistan. So how has this affected you? Because you originally broke the story about one of the leaders of these kill squads, and then you were subsequently sued by him and by a powerful media magnate in Australia, Kerry Stokes. So has the official report vindicated you?
It has yet to fully play out. No names were in the official report. I am facing litigation alongside my colleague, Nick McKenzie, and in that's still alive, there's probably not much that I can really say about that, but it's certainly been a very tough time for us both. This is uncomfortable reading. Prime Minister admitted that himself. This is a difficult subject for any nation. They don't want to believe that their heroes are committing these atrocious acts and that, you know, war brings out the worst as well as the best in people. But I think it's been extremely important that we get to the truth of what occurred for the sake of the integrity of our armed forces and our international reputation. I'm actually proud that Australia has leaned in, and I think the Inspector General has done an extraordinary job. You know, the other thing, Ian, is that this is such tough territory. These soldiers are trained to keep their secrets to a point where, you know, they endure interrogation training. You know, they're very, very good at maintaining silence. So for that cone of silence to be penetrated itself is extraordinary. But when I first began reporting on these matters, I had no idea of the scale of it. We were aware of a few allegations of perhaps, say, one alleged rogue patrol. But as you pointed out, you know, there are now 19 referrals to the Australian Federal Police, you know, we're talking about 39 alleged murders and up to 60 particular incidents.
Well, the investigation that you mentioned was conducted by Major General Justice Paul Brereton, and most of these guilty, or accused, I should say, are members of the Elite Special Air Services, the SAS. And my understanding is that your original story that you broke, which you got sued for, was in effect outing a war hero as a war criminal. He had received the Victoria Cross, which is the equivalent of the American Congressional Medal of Honor. This is Robert Smith, and he's employed by Kerry Stokes, who runs the Australian 7 TV network and is a powerful media figure, along with Rupert Murdoch, whose media has also come after you. So at this point, the case that you have is still alive in spite of it being completely undercut by the revelations, and particularly now that the Prime Minister has weighed in. You just wonder, what are they doing? Why are they still pursuing you?
Well, the presumption of innocence still applies, and nobody was named in the Brereton report. As I said before, I have to be careful about what I say about this specific matter involving Ben Robert Smith. He has said himself that he is the subject of this inquiry, a subject of this inquiry, but you know, that whole matter, that whole process is now moving into a second phase where these referrals go to the Australian Federal Police. The government has set up a special investigator's office. There's a lot of difference between an inquisitorial Royal Commission type process, which is about raising information, but not necessarily prosecutable evidence. So there was a lot of criticism that the old process of the Inspector General took so long, 4 years. I mean, I have a better understanding of why it took so long, because, as I mentioned, it's extraordinarily difficult to find witnesses who will admit that that bad things happened. But it's yet to be formed into evidence, and so that new process begins. And our sense, Ian, is that it may well take another 10 years for the prosecution process to play out. And it's uncomfortable for any nation. I mean, the United States had its My Lai matter, Vietnam, all those years ago, and a chief perpetrator, alleged perpetrator, William Kelly, was actually identified and charged, but essentially served no real custodial sentence. More recently, the United States has prosecuted alleged war criminals from the Afghanistan conflict, but again, it's clear from your president, etc., that there's not a huge amount of appetite for locking up people who risk their lives. And I think that's going to play out in Australia as well. There's going to be a big and important public debate about where responsibility really lies.
And again, I'm speaking with Chris Masters, who's in Australia. He retains the record for the longest-serving reporter on Australia's longest-running current affairs program, Four Corners. For over 25 years, he's made a series of nation-shaping reports, among them the Moonlight State, which helped trigger Queensland's Fitzgerald Commission, which brought down a corrupt state government. And he's received multiple awards, including the Premier Gold Walkley, which is the equivalent of the US Pulitzer, for his international expose of the sinking of the Rainbow Warrior. And he's the author of 5 best-selling books, the most recent of which is No Frontline, Australian Special Forces at War in Afghanistan. In 2017, Chris Masters was inducted into the Australian Media Hall of Fame. So let's talk about your reporting in Afghanistan. I don't know how many times you went there, but when you were doing your research for your book, No Frontline, in Afghanistan, did you hear anything about these extrajudicial killings?
No, I didn't. I went 3 times. The first 2 times I was with conventional forces who haven't, for what it's worth, been so tainted by these allegations. The last time I went in 2011 was with special forces, and I'm still the only Australian reporter to have ever embedded with Australian special forces. Look, when I was there, you know, obviously I wasn't in the thick of the action. They weren't going to let me too much closer to danger. Not that I stayed in the base. I did actually go out patrolling, etc., with the soldiers. But I was never going to see things. Things weren't going to happen in front of a reporter. I saw prisoners, etc., you know, PUCs as they were called, persons under control, being brought back for questioning, etc. I saw the hatred in their eyes. I must admit, that woke me up a little bit. But I wasn't to see anything that was anything like what we'd now describe as a war crime, for reasons you could expect. It's also worth saying that on the rotation that I did, there are no real allegations that emerged. The interesting thing about the SAS is that, as with all special forces, there's a real dual personality there. They call them the compassionate psychopaths, and you know, they have to be capable of killing without hesitation, but at the same time having a moral compass and the character to know, you know, when to apply lethal force. As they'll often say, the shot not fired is more important than the one that is fired. And the SAS people that I was with at the time were very impressive, were very restrained, and they were proud of the fact that they would go into the field for weeks on end with no shot being fired, and yet being able to take high-value targets as they put them off the field by capturing rather than killing them. The Inspector General's inquiry, as we now see it, show that for that period that I was there, you know, no bad stuff really occurred. It really got much worse much later as the war bled on and the metric for success became more difficult to understand. I think that it was a brutalizing experience for many of the soldiers. I think they were very frustrated by what they called this catch and release system, where they were bringing back suspected insurgents, but without the evidence to detain them, they were then released back onto the battlefield. And, you know, you'd get a typical scenario whereby somebody who'd been captured would later be found to be responsible for an IED blast, you know, a roadside bomb that killed a great many coalition soldiers. So I think that hardened the hearts of a great many soldiers. And even though it was clearly against the rules of engagement, they began to take the law into their own hands by conducting these summary executions in the field. You know, they may say that this bloke doesn't clearly represent a threat, he's got no weapon on him, but he is participating in hostilities. We know that if we leave him out here, he's a danger to us. And for what it's worth, I think that attitude wasn't just in the corridors of the Australian troops. I mean, I think the Americans, the British, a lot of Special Forces soldiers felt much the same.
But some of this footage, though, came from helmet cameras. They were leaked to the ABC, and you worked for the ABC for Four Corners for, as we mentioned, you'd been their longest-running reporter. That footage apparently shows an Australian soldier with a captive Afghan who's on his knees, and I think he turns to his superior officer and says, "Should I drop this? I can't use the word on the air," and then proceeds to shoot this guy twice in the chest and once in the head as he strolls by. That footage was shown, I believe, on Australian television, and it prompted a raid by the federal police. So tell us about that.
No. Well, there's some truth in that, but it didn't prompt the raid. The raid had occurred earlier, and it was over different reporting. A different reporter, in fact, had published what they call the Afghan files, and this wasn't nearly as graphic. You know, there were images, etc., of deceased persons on the battlefield, but no hard evidence of war crimes, just suspicion, and that had been already published some time earlier. But because it was classified information, the Australian Federal Police ultimately felt compelled to raid the ABC and charge that particular reporter. The incident that you just referred to, that was subsequently leaked to the ABC, to the reporter who then went on to cover the war crimes issue, Mark Willesey. Mark Willesey only this week was awarded that Australian Pulitzer, the Gold Walkley, for some extraordinary work. And we're very grateful to those soldiers for allowing this information to go public, because it actually demonstrates that there are a great many people in Special Forces who have had a lot of moral courage, who've been outraged by the conduct of some of their fellows in that particular incident, which I think woke up the Australian public. There's nothing like seeing it for yourself. I mean, we'd been reporting this stuff for quite some time, but there on the screens of the nation, people saw for themselves a man in the field representing no apparent threat, just handling his prayer beads, lying on the ground, having been mauled by one of the combat attack dogs, and then the soldier leaning over him says, as you said, you know, should I kill this fellow? So there are quite a few spectators around, and it takes a while. I mean, you know, there's 30-odd seconds before the trigger is actually pulled. So not only was it revealing of what appeared to be a war crime, because the man didn't appear to represent any kind of threat, but there's this bystander problem as well. You know, how come that nobody says, no, we don't do that, we don't do that? And ultimately that bloke was shot to death.
Well, just in closing, what do you expect? I mean, you're obviously reluctant to talk about the lawsuit that's against you for originally breaking the story about the war hero who is accused of being a war criminal, even though he wasn't named in this report. He himself apparently has mentioned that he's in jeopardy, I guess.
He mentions that he's subject to the inquiry, but he also absolutely insists that he has no case to answer, that he is completely innocent.
Right. But he's backed by a billionaire media mogul. So, and the Australian libel laws are the same ones that they have in the UK, and they go back to the same libel laws that the American revolutionaries fought against in the American Revolution. And that's why we have a First Amendment here in the United States, because of Jefferson and others who tried to bring forth a revolution, but were hampered every time by the libel laws. So I don't know. Obviously, there's not going to be a change in that in any time soon, although President Trump has said he'd like to have those kind of libel laws in the United States. So at the end of the day, obviously, there's some soul-searching going on with the Australian military. But what about the country at large? Are they embarrassed by this? Are they processing it in any helpful and useful way?
I think the debate is really only beginning. As I mentioned before, this is an uncomfortable subject for all Australians. Australians are particularly proud of their military history. You know, the Australian War Memorial is a revered public institution, as you know, Ian, growing up here. You know, Anzac Day is secular. You know, it's probably one of Australia's most important public days. So there is a lot of soul searching. There is a lot of pain. The Chief of the Defence Force spoke of this. And I mean, I'm personally proud of the fact that Australia is prepared to confront the truth. And that I think we had an unusual situation where a bunch of senior commanders decided that they wouldn't sweep this under the carpet. There is a big issue that's emerged nevertheless about the culpability of leadership, you know, and I still am perplexed by the notion that these many events, you know, 39 alleged murders occurred over a period of 7 years, and no officer seemed to know anything about it. I mean, nobody's admitted in the chain of command to knowing what was going on or conceding that there was any kind of a systemic problem. They are conceding that there was a cultural problem that happens with special forces, considered to be so special that they become autonomous and exempt from conventional rules of command, and that Australia's special forces community, the third largest in Afghanistan after Britain and the United States, answered more to U.S. and ISAF command than it did to its own leadership. And the autonomy of special forces was such that when they operated in small teams in the field, officers weren't around. But for all that, it baffles me that all this occurred and no officers knew anything about it. But having said that, equally, of course, you know, this has been called out by leadership, and I think that is to their credit and to Australia's credit.
Well, Chris Masters, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Good on you, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Chris Masters, who is in Australia. He retains the record for the longest-serving reporter on Australia's longest-running current affairs program, Four Corners. And for over 25 years, he's made a series of nation-shaping reports, among them the Moonlight State, which helped trigger Queensland's Fitzgerald Commission, which brought down a corrupt state government. He has received multiple awards, including the Premier Gold Walkley, the equivalent of the American Pulitzer, for his international expose of the sinking of the Rainbow Warrior. And he's the author of five best-selling books, the most recent of which is No Front Line, Australian Special Forces at War in Afghanistan. And in 2017, Chris Masters was inducted into the Australian Media Hall of Fame. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. To help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate free, we have added a donate button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. The other became